The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. What Lies Beneath? R.C. Riggs. In the deep, far, far beyond, where the last flicker of sunlight fades away into an inky blackness, where the cold slows heartbeats to a nearly imperceptible pulse, and the incredible pressure of the ocean above warps the bones of ancient ships that lay deathly still on the seafloor, an unseeing eye blinks sleep away. Eons had passed along the surface as the creature slept. Pluffs of clay muddies the water as it slowly writhes, working out its body's stiffness from its long slumber. In the deep, something dark stirs, one thought rippling across its neurons. We hunger. Tektite 4 to support barge, reporting for day 8 check-in. Sylvia adjusted the headset to sit more comfortably on her ears as she started her rotation, managing Tektite 4's communication system, while the rest of the small crew bustled around the habitat, getting started on their assigned daily tasks. She updated the surface support team on their status. All systems and personnel functioning normally, well, as normally as one can, at the bottom of the ocean at least. Off the coast of Guam, the Tektite 4 habitat was installed 6 feet above the seafloor in the Challenger Deep, anchored by tethers sunk through the 1,600 feet of accumulated sediment into the oceanic crust in the trench. At 35,870 feet deep, the Tektite 4 crew were collecting world records daily, breaking new ground in time spent in the deepest reach of the ocean. 8 days into the 30-day mission, the crew of Tektite 4 had already firmly secured their place in scientific history, advancing human knowledge in a wide swath of disciplines, in engineering, geology, biology, mineral resources, and medicine. Sylvia glanced at the biological sample storage area, knowing that even more exciting discoveries awaited once they started identifying organisms. She was sure there would be scores of new species discovered within the jars of samples that were packed carefully in storage crates. As the biological mission specialist on the team, those samples were her babies. She couldn't wait to get into her lab back at Scripps Institute of Oceanography to begin studying these creatures. While she was responsible for directing communications today, a task they all rotated through, she also pored through the hours of video footage collected on each of their EHAs, extra habitat activities. The high-definition camera mounted on their helmets recorded a nearly 360-degree view, illuminated by the helmet lights. The smart lights increased their intensity automatically as the suit moved further away from other suits or the habitat, finally balancing recording as much information as possible without blinding the rest of the crew. In hour 213 of Uri's Day 7 footage, Sylvia thought she caught something unusual in the view behind Uri and immediately paused the playback. She pulled up the map to see where he was and what direction the camera had been facing. A plume of sediment rose from the seafloor close to the plate boundary. She checked the seismographic records to see if a small earthquake could be responsible for the plume. But there had been no tectonic movement. They hadn't seen much macrofauna yet. Life was slow in the cold, deep water, and big things were rare. This could be their first sighting of something big enough to disturb the sediment. Rewinding the recording, she watched again, timing how long she could see the plume. The densest, most compact plume persisted for about 4 seconds before it spread out enough to no longer be distinguishable from the infinite black of the deep ocean beyond. But wait, she thought, what's that? Playing the same section back and forth, she squinted at the screen, focusing on the bottom of the plume. She paused to rub her burning eyes, wondering if she was just imagining motion at the bottom of the plume. In the mission log, she made note of the strange plume, recording the location, time, and video file, identifying it as worth investigating later. Notes made, she tried to get back to her regularly scheduled tasks. After 20 minutes, however, her curiosity got the better of her, and she looked at her teammates' current positions. If someone is near that location, I'll have them do a quick evaluation. Likely, whatever had made that plume had moved on and was far away, and this all would just be another mystery for the books, but maybe they could get lucky and find tracks in the sediment or something that could help shed light on the source of the plume and advance humanity's knowledge of the deep sea. Pulling up the map, she pinned the plume's coordinates and looked at the blinking dots representing her teammates. One dot was blinking within 300 feet of the plume's pin. Alina, the geologic mission specialist, was close by, currently extracting a core of deep sea sediment located right along the plate boundary. One of many the team was scheduled to collect in their 30-day mission. Tektite 4 to Alina, come in. This made it official. While making a note would, of course, be part of the official record of the mission, actively investigating makes it so much more important and notable. Sylvia's heart picked up a swifter beat as her nerves caused her to second-guess her instinct. We were encouraged to follow our curiosity, so no one is going to be mad at me, she reminded herself. We have dedicated time for open exploration. That's all this is. Alina, to Tektite 4, what you got for me? Alina's accent brought a smile to Sylvia's face. The crew of Tektite 4 was chosen, in part for their camaraderie. Being in such close quarters for several weeks required a group of people who could work and live well together. Alina hid her intellect, wit, and heart behind the kind of brashness one could only hone over a lifetime navigating crowded New York City subways during rush hour. Still, that brashiness also made her a fierce peacemaker on the team. When you're done with your current task, I'm assigning you extra credit to investigate something funny. I picked up in Uri's footage from yesterday. Mr. Grossman, my sixth grade teacher, would tell you he had a hard enough time getting me to do the regular credit work, much less the extra stuff. But for you, kid, I'll do your extra credit. Plus, I love funky stuff. Sylvia relayed the coordinates of the plume and a quick rundown on what to keep an eye out for. If no tracks or animals were visible on the sediment surface, she would dig down about a foot in a small transect to see if anything could be nudged loose. You got it. I'm just about done with this core. I'll cap it and set the inflatable to send it up to the surface and then head towards your mystery. Sylvia activated the live feed from Alina's helmet camera. She watched as the bulbous arms of the deep-sea dive suit put pressure caps on both ends of a 6-foot-long tube filled with finely striped sediment, secured a strange deflated balloon to the tube, and activated a chemical reaction, causing the balloon to fill with air and float away toward the surface. Needing to rise over 35,000 feet of ocean depth, it would take about 7 hours to reach the surface before the GPS beacon would activate, summoning the recovery team on the support barge. Alina took several minutes in the lumbering dive suit to make her way toward Sylvia's mysterious plume. Stuck in the habitat, she paced in front of the communication cubby, trying to work off her excitement. The crackle of the radio startled her. Alina to Tech Type 4, approaching pinned location, turning lights up to maximum. Sylvia dropped into the desk chair and pulled herself as close to the live feed as she could, straining to see through the water as Alina approached the mark. Her spirits fell as nothing unusual appeared in the sediment. Alina to Tech Type 4, all looks quiet on the western front. Tech Type 4 to Alina, dig a 1-foot deep trench, 6 feet across the plate boundary. Alina to Tech Type 4, roger, leaving the channel open. The dive suit's arms deployed a spade and began to dig in the sediment. The water in front of the camera slowly began to fill with brightness as the fine sediment became suspended as Alina dug. The radio transmitted her ragged breaths from the exertion of manipulating the arms of the dive suit. A loud snap reverberated through the open radio line. What the? But Alina's transmission suddenly ended in a burst of static, and then silence. As Sylvia watched the feed, the bright sediment illuminated by the suit's light suddenly went black, as though the light had been switched off. Tech Type 4 to Alina, come in. Silence. Tech Type 4 to Alina, don't play games, report. Still silence. Tech Type 4 to Alina, report. Only silence followed. Okay, don't panic. Think, there was probably a connection failure on Alina's suit. I'm sure she's fine. I'll just send someone else to help her. Sylvia scanned the map, trying to ignore that there were only 2 teammate positions on the map, where there should have been 3. Conrad's position is next closest. Tech Type 4 to Conrad. Alina seems to have had a transmission failure. Please redirect for an assist. Conrad to Tech Type 4, roger. I was already on my way. That last transmission was way too creepy for my taste. Getting to her last known position will take me some time. Uri to Tech Type 4, I'm also on my way to last known position for Alina. If the suit is dead stick, it may take the two of us to get her back to the habitat. Tektite 4, copy. I'll start the entry sequence on the habitat to get you all in quickly. Conrad and Uri left their comms open, so she heard their quickened breathing as they moved as swiftly as the dive suits could go. The two red dots were slowly converging on the pin Sylvia had set for the stupid sediment plume. She activated the live feeds for both of their suits on separate monitors. One monitor still showed the black from Alina's, and the other two showed Conrad and Uri's movement through the subtly changing landscape. After what felt like an eternity, Conrad and Uri reported being within visibility range of Alina's less known position. "Look, isn't that the spade from her suit?" Uri's suit arm pointed off towards his left in the live feed. "Damn, the thing is snapped in half." Conrad approached and angled the camera to record the damage. He then straightened and slowly moved himself in a circle. "Tektite 4, can you identify any disturbances in the sediment from your view in the cameras?" Sylvia carefully scanned the 360 views in both feeds. "Conrad and Uri, the only sediment disturbance I can see is your tracks for about a foot of the trench," Alina had started. "Where did she go?" "Yo, Uri, look off towards bearing 272. Do you see what I think I see?" Sylvia panned Conrad's feed to bearing 272 and strained to make out anything other than empty seafloor. "Wait, is that..." And then Sylvia heard a cacophony of unintelligible overlapping transmissions from both men, and the screens went blindingly bright with sediment before going entirely dark. "Oh, but Uri never finished that syllable. Only a single pin pulsed on the map, while three black screens stared at Sylvia. A thundering sound filled Sylvia's head, a deafening pulse that didn't abate even after she whipped the headset off and pressed her hands against her ears. Only then did she realize the thunder was only the rapid pounding of her heart. Her body was in motion before she had fully thought about her actions. She had her dive suit on and was heading towards the exit chamber. She had already prepped the system for entry, so getting herself out into the ocean was a quick process. While the dive suits had a heating system, she hadn't given hers time to warm up, so the chill of the deep ocean quickly worked its way through the suit. Her shivers were half in response to the temperature and half from the fear. She grabbed the quick jet as the suit's independent propulsion system was too slow. She needed to help her teammates. The screen on her suit's arm helped her navigate swiftly toward where only a single pin blinked on the map. The dots representing her three teammates were disturbingly absent. When she was on top of the pin, she slowed the quick jet and set its anchoring tether into the seafloor. She stood still, looking for any evidence of her missing teammates, but the darkness seemed to be pressing in around her. She saw the snapped spade, half covered in sediment, next to the abandoned trench. A glint of something in the sediment caught her eye, and she stepped towards it to get a better look. It almost looked like a piece of a dive suit, but whose, and what happened to the rest of it? As she got closer, the darkness became even more oppressive. She had initially attributed it to fear for her teammates, but then realized that the light on her suit was getting dimmer. Her wrist buzzed, and she looked at the map. A blinking dot suddenly appeared just a few feet away from her. Another buzz, another dot, and then another. Three blinking dots, almost on top of each other, moving towards her. And her light was getting dimmer. Her suit recognized the proximity of her teammates, but why couldn't she see them? They should be right there, right above where the dive suit fragment lay in the sediment. But the darkness was so rich and deep and full of body that Sylvia was sure she could reach out and touch it. And at that moment, she was certain of the darkness's solidity. An instinct shuddered through Sylvia's nervous system, something deep and primal that passed all modern, evolved, rational thought. As swiftly as her body had been in motion to leave the habitat and get to her teammates, her body was again in motion, away from the body of the darkness and back towards the safety of the habitat. Her legs moved to run, but the lethargy of the drive suit and the viscosity of the water recalled the painful and agonizing slowness of running in a nightmare. Except she knew this wasn't a nightmare, at least not one she could wake up from. One foot in front of another, she ran towards the habitat, focused intently on the red light of the entry hatch, a hopeful beacon just out of reach. Two more steps, and I'm safe. And then all went dark around her, the habitat disappearing from view. Support barge to Tektite 4, come in. Support barge to Tektite 4, come in. The hum of chatter from the crowd of reporters died down and recorders were held up as a man in a rumpled suit solemnly stepped to the podium. The scruff of his beard and the deep purple shadows under his eyes exposed the profound toll of months of sleeplessness. After an extensive investigation, we have concluded that the tragedy that befell the Tellkite 4 Aquanauts 3 months ago was due to systemic flaws in the dive suits. Under repeated use at over 1,000 atmospheres of pressure in the Challenger Deep, the dive suits experienced catastrophic and instantaneous collapse. It will take years for us to fully identify and fix the fundamental flaws in these suits, and we are suspending the Tektite project indefinitely. Though this tragedy is unimaginable for the families of the Tektite 4 Aquanauts and for humanity at the loss of these brilliant and brave scientists, we can take a small measure of comfort that they did not suffer. The rapid failure of the suits could have happened in a fraction of a multisecond, faster than the brain can transmit information. We honor our lost friends by continuing their work and ensuring their sacrifice was not in vain. We have already identified 32 new species and deepened our understanding of the complex forces of the subduction zone. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the family and friends of the crew of the Tektite 4. Thank you. In the last frame recorded from Aquanaut Sylvia Parker's dive camera in the front-facing view, the red ring glowed, marking the entrance to the Tektite 4 habitat. But that's not what the graduate student was fixated on. It was the rear-facing view, where she could just make out three faint glows with a dark web of veins crisscrossing across them as if the lights were deep inside and an unimaginably large dark creature. The sound recorded on the Parker feed was her rapid panicked breathing that suddenly ended in a gasp. But the graduate student thought she heard something else, the faintest ripple of sound from the water. We hunger. And then silence. Path of Totality by Bryce Matt. Sophie walked into the police station and looked around. It wasn't as busy as she was expecting, but then again, she wasn't entirely sure what to expect. Today was the first total solar eclipse in almost 7 years. Everyone all over the country had been talking about it, and the citizens of Rucker, Texas, were no different. In the week leading up to it, people were starting to go a little stir-crazy in anticipation. "Hey, Lieutenant," Troy smiled. "Didn't think you'd be coming in today." "And miss all the fun?" Sophie smiled back. "How's it been here?" "Oddly calm." The phone rang, and Troy immediately picked it up. "Rucker Police Department. Troy speaking. How may I help you?" Sophie continued on into the station, nodding hello to a few of the officers as she passed by. She stepped into her office and set her bag down on her desk. Almost immediately, there was a knock at her door. "Lieutenant." Sophie turned and saw Jerry Adams, one of her lead investigators, leaning halfway into her office. "I could use your help on something over here."
"And she hasn't said anything?" Sophie asked.
She and Jerry were standing at the small bank of monitors that showed the feed from all of the cameras placed throughout the station. The one they were focused on showed the interview room. Sitting at the far end of the table, the furthest from the door, was a young blonde woman, about 25 years of age. She was obviously exhausted, but clearly too frightened to let herself relax. Her wide eyes betrayed at least that much.
No, not really. The few times we started talking to her, she almost got violent with us. I thought maybe letting her relax for a bit might help, but not so far. She pretty much won't let us enter the room.
Who took her in there?
Doyle, Jerry said.
Sophie nodded. Doyle was always good with people, especially women. Her naturally kind face put everyone at ease.
She was first on the scene?
Yep. There were a few phone calls about a young woman running through the streets half-clothed, pushing into people and talking crazy.
Sophie gave them a look.
Those were their words, not mine, Jerry explained.
What was it she was saying?
Nothing that made much sense, apparently. He looked at his notes. Mainly gibberish and half-completed sentences, a lot of who and where's, things like that.
Did she say anything to Doyle?
No. She just stared out the windows on the drive over here. She was like in awe of her surroundings. Doyle said she seemed utterly confused.
He put his notes away and looked at the lieutenant.
About everything.
Sophie studied the image on the monitor. The young woman was wearing torn shirts, a police-issue sweatshirt and side sandals.
She wasn't wearing a shirt or shoes?
She barely had one on, and, he looked at his notes again, no shoes and really only one sock. The other was almost completely fallen apart.
Sophie shook her head slowly.
Okay, she said after a moment. I'm going to go in and talk with her.
There was a knock at the door. The young woman immediately tensed and pushed herself back into her chair. The door opened, and Sophie stepped inside the room. She didn't go much farther than the doorway, just enough to close it behind her. She smiled.
Hi, I'm Lieutenant Stevens. I'd like to talk to you, if that's okay.
The young woman didn't say anything.
Are you hungry or thirsty? We have some sandwiches in the break room, and there's a soda machine in there.
The young woman just stared at Sophie.
Maybe in a little bit, then. She took another step forward. Is it okay if I sit down? I'll stay on this side of the table. I just want to be able to talk to you. The young woman still didn't react. She just continued to stare intently at Sophie, drawing back slightly as Sophie sat down at the table. "Thank you," Sophie said. "Like I said, I'm Lieutenant Stevens. Can you tell me your name?" No answer. "It would just make our conversation go better if I could refer to you by your name." At first, the young woman still didn't respond. Then softly, she said, "Taylor." "I'm sorry?" Sophie asked. "Taylor," she repeated louder this time. Sophie smiled. "It's very nice to meet you, Taylor. My name is Sophie." Taylor just sat there. "Do you have a last name?" Sophie asked, adding a slight chuckle. "I mean, of course you do. Everybody does, right?" "Humphrey," Taylor finally relented. Sophie gave a warm, genuine smile. "Thank you for telling me, Taylor. I appreciate you doing that." It was definitely a step forward. But it also meant that Jerry Adams was now running Taylor Humphrey's name through the system. "You're not from here, are you, Taylor?" Sophie continued. "I mean, I don't recognize you. Do you have any family here?" Taylor shook her head. "Oregon." "You're from Oregon?" Taylor shook her head again. "No, Seattle. My aunt is in Oregon, Eugene." "You were visiting her then?" Taylor nodded. "Like a family reunion sort of thing?" "No," Taylor said quietly. Her voice was steady now, but still very weak. "The eclipse. We wanted to see it. Together." "In Oregon?" Sophie furrowed her brow. "I didn't think you could see it there. Or did you mean that you came here to see it?" "No," Taylor said, shaking her head. "We were in Oregon." "Okay, then, so..." There was a knock at the door. Sophie stood up. "I need to see what this is about, but I'll be right back, and I'll bring you a sandwich or two. You can pick whichever you want. They're all pretty good." Jerry Adams was waiting excitedly for Sophie. As soon as she stepped out of the interview room, he held up a piece of paper. On it was a photo of Taylor Humphrey, looking almost identical to how she looked now, only happier. She had a big smile on her face, and her eyes were bright and alive. "Meet Taylor Humphrey, reported missing by her aunt, August 21st, 2017, from Eugene, Oregon." He handed Sophie the paper. "They were there to see the solar eclipse." "Another one?" "The last one that was visible in the United States. They got together, reportedly had a great time, but then Taylor up and disappeared without a trace. No one has seen or heard from her in 7 years." "And she shows up here for another solar eclipse?" "Well, I have a theory," Jerry said, unable to keep himself from grinning. "But I need you to hear me out before you call me crazy again. Fair warning, you're going to need to be willing to at least look into the rabbit hole on this one." Sophie rolled her eyes as one of the office phones began to ring. Jerry didn't wait for an official answer. "Okay, so 7 years ago, there was a total solar eclipse, just like today. But do you know what else happened today?" Sophie obliged. "No, I don't at all, Jerry. Today is also the day that the CERN Institute turned the Large Hadron Collider back on." He waited for the realization to hit her. It didn't. "I don't know what that is, Jerry." A few more phones started ringing in the station. "It's a giant piece of equipment that they built in Switzerland to study atoms and the beginnings of the universe and something called the God particle. But a lot of people believe, and this is where it gets weird, that what it accidentally did was tear a hole in time and space." Sophie stared at him. Then, are you kidding me right now? Jerry started to answer, but was cut off by Dan Phillips, one of the other officers. Sorry to interrupt, guys, but we could really use some help on the phones out here. What's going on? Sophie asked. Jerry went to answer yet another ringing telephone. We're getting multiple reports of people going missing out of nowhere, Phillips explained. 8 so far. 8? Sophie repeated in astonishment. Yeah, and climbing. He picked up another ringing line. Sophie looked over at Jerry and listened in on his conversation. Was it in the middle of the square or down one of the side streets? He asked the caller. In the square? Okay. And no one saw her wander off? Suddenly, Sophie's blood ran ice cold, and she spun around towards the interview room. She broke out into a dead run. She reached the interview room door and flung it open. Inside were the table and both chairs, just as they had been a few minutes before. Taylor, however, was gone. Sophie turned back around and called out into the station. Did anyone see her leave? Who saw her leave? She quickly moved forward a few steps. The ringing of the telephones had completely filled the room. Anyone? Did anyone see her leave? Amanda walked up the steps of the police station and walked inside. The station house was bustling as usual. She didn't even make it to the detective's bullpen before Adam Miller thrusted a handful of paperwork at her. I need your help in room 2, he said hurriedly. With what? I'm not sure. We don't get a lot of information on her. Her? Amanda asked. Yeah. And she keeps asking for someone named Lieutenant Stevens. Who's Lieutenant Stevens? Room 2, he shouted as he hurried away, tapping his earpiece. Amanda thumbed through the paperwork. Wait, no one did a retinal scan or a digiprint? Amanda opened the door to the interview room and walked in. Standing in the middle of the room was a young woman with blonde hair. Her sweatshirt was in tatters. Hello, I'm Detective Taylor spun around. Where's Lieutenant Stevens? She screamed. I'm sorry, but I don't know who that is. I'd like to help you, though. Could you? Am I still in Texas? Amanda was taken aback by this. No, you're in Montana. Taylor's shoulders slumped as she pushed her hair back from her face. Is it at least 2017 again? She asked softly. A look of concern spread across Amanda's face. No, it's 2044. August 23, 2044. Hearing this, Taylor collapsed into a heap on the floor. She began weeping. I'm supposed to be in Oregon, she said, with my family. Amanda stood there watching her cry. From somewhere out in the police station, phones started to ring. At least there's no HOA by Pat Royson. The Edge always gave Rick the heebie-jeebies. He deactivated the till setting on his new Spider Deluxe, silencing the low thrumming noise of jagged claws that had been working the ground below, then killed the engine. The machine's legs stretched and the body lifted, raising Rick's vantage and giving the impression that the Edge was creeping inward, encroaching on his land like weeds to wheat. In a few minutes, his neighbor's property, now only a slow-moving speck, hardly visible against the spackled backdrop of deep space, would swing close enough for Rick to count the steps on John and Linda Barker's front porch. Twice a year, the Barkers' off-kilter orbit brought their residents within spitting distance, though he'd be hard-pressed to get anything, let alone spit, through the thick, airtight dome encircling his home. The dome's interior displays served as a window to outside, producing an image so clear and realistic that Rick, after setting the image to blue sky over landscape, very nearly suffered a concussion bumping into it. Today he set the image to real-time patch through so he could watch the passing of the Barkers with his own two eyes. 5 years prior, Rick, having grown tired of reading through the immense amount of mail he'd often receive, mail which certainly outnumbered the distant stars and a Rick were of a similar significance, did not read the notice that detailed the addition of a new orbiting body, and was surprised when a blip on his radar, one he'd never seen before, traced an uncomfortably close trajectory. But all worry vanished when old John Barker flicked the light switch in his two-story classic, flashing a message of neighborly peace and good humor. The next pass, Rick waved from the seat of his ancient Kruber like a madman, and the rest was history. Nowadays, it wouldn't feel like June without a wave from old John. The speck that was John's farm grew into a fleck. After a moment, Rick could make out tiny particles and patches of color from John's exterior display. A few minutes later, there was their lawn, a fresh and rich green patch, and then the white siding and red roof of their house, and then the gaps of green in the spaces of their white picket fence. That's where he'd always see John, both hands on a picket, at least until he spotted Rick. And then he'd lift an arm and wave a wave a lover would be jealous of. But John wasn't there. Rick squinted at the fence line surrounding the house, at the beautifully kept lawn, at the porch with two rocking chairs, at the windows glowing with the light of a loving home. There, in one of the top windows, something obscured the warmth. A dark shape moved across in a flash, as if a leak in the roof had allowed the emptiness of space to pour past the window and flood the top floor. But that wasn't true. If there had been a breach, the dome would have made it clear. Rick had seen more than one breach dome in his time, and the brilliant lights reminded him of fireworks, only he could see them across 100,000 miles. Maybe more. Rick removed a terminal from his pocket, navigated to the display controls, then connected to the nearest panel. It meant he'd have to approach the edge. Heebie-jeebies be damned, he'd been looking forward to showing old John his new spider. The section of display Rick had connected to broke from the pattern of its neighbors and magnified the view of John's farm. Just as before, John was nowhere to be seen. He magnified further, zooming toward the window in which he'd seen movement. Another flash of black. This time Rick could tell it was a person, though he'd assumed that from the start. The person, however, moved far too quickly. John and Linda were old, and this shadow moved with the quickness of youth. No, Rick was awfully sure the person moving about John at Linda's house was neither John nor Linda. In the 5 years they'd been waving to each other, Rick and John had only spoken a few times, and it had mostly been pleasantries. Rick would tell his wife that he'd be out by the edge to see his old buddy, and Rose would roll her eyes, tell him to just give the man a call, for goodness sakes. Rick flipped his terminal to communication and dialed John's home phone. It rang a total of 3 times before John and Linda's voices spoke in tandem. We're the Barkers. Bark at the tone. Rick pocketed the terminal and took in a deep, deep breath. The Barkers never mentioned any family, any friends, any common visitors. Drop-ins were as unlikely as a thunderstorm, save for the religious types that came calling now and again. There was only one thing to do, the neighborly thing, and he had to do it fast. Rick let out the breath all at once, and as he pulled the terminal back out of his pocket, he dialed Rose. "Howdy, sweetheart," he said as he always would. "I'm heading out for a bit. got a fritzy screen. Rose sighed. Be safe, Rick. Dinner's in 30. Rick hung up and removed his suit from the barn, put it on, then keyed his intentions. The airlock door hissed as it opened, and Rick entered the tiny room. He ran the final suit diagnostic before initializing this depressurization. There was another hiss, then silence took over. The opposite door opened, and suddenly he was staring at the expanse of space as if it were the gullet of one of those space eldritches, or whatever they called them. He pushed out over the edge. Floating came easy, mostly because Rick's suit did all the work. He barely felt the vent chambers open on his back, the compressed gases bursting out, the sudden increase in speed. The only indication that he was moving faster was his shrinking home and the slowing approach of John's. His suit, unable to trust the dexterity of a human being, gripped a bar on the outside of John's airlock and pulled him close. The airlock door opened of its own, and Rick's suit pulled them inside. After another series of hisses, Rick was standing on the grass. He removed his suit and set it next to the airlock door. The air was fresh, clean, indistinguishable from his own, aside from the scent of rain-washed grass, which, Rick knew, could be achieved via terminal command. For some reason, Rose had never been keen on the fragrance, instead insisting on ocean spray or wooded retreat. Rick unlatched the picket gate and made his way up the porch steps, three, as he'd always counted, past the antique rockers with their floral cushions colored vibrantly as if they'd just been purchased, and approached the door. He pressed the doorbell and could hear the two-tone ding-dong that had been popularized long, long ago, yet somehow persisted. Old John was old school. There was a shuffle inside. The deadbolt clicked, and the knob turned. It was Linda. "Oh, hey, Rick. We didn't see you come up." Rick decided they must not have been near a terminal. Rose would sometimes set hers aside, too. "To escape," she'd say. "Howdy, Linda. John home?" Linda said, "he's inside, but he's really busy." "Oh," Rick said. "Everything okay? I could have sworn I saw something moving around. I didn't mean to interrupt your entertaining." "Nope," Linda said, suddenly bright. "Just me and John. It was nice to see you. Give my love to the missus." "You got it, ma'am." Rick moved across the porch, past the two rockers, down the steps, 1, 2, 3, and back to his suit. He put it on and sat in the grass, arms on his knees, chin on his arms, looking out at the sky. Sparkling stars widened into starbursts. Rick's suit warned him of an irregular discharge within its helmet, then played a soothing, hopeful melody as he waited for the drone to carry him home.